You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
In 2022, the Supreme Court used the idea of damage to a person's mana to overturn Peter Ellis's historic convictions for child sexual abuse. In two more recent cases, Green and Police, and Sweeney and prison manager of Spring Hill Corrections Facility, the courts too engaged with the concept of mana. I spoke to lecturer at the University of Canterbury's Faculty of Law, Rachel Evans, Ngāti Tama, Ngāti Pāmoana, about the significance of the precedents these cases set and how the courts have measured mana. I began the interview asking her about these cases and how each of them engaged with this concept.
If we start with Ellis, which I think that's still the leading case in this area. So Mr. Ellis had been convicted of historic sexual abuse against children in the 90s, and he had gone through various appeal processes and had been unsuccessful. And in 2019, he lodged an appeal with the Supreme Court, a sort of last gasp appeal for them to look into his convictions. And at that time, he was very ill with cancer. Now, unfortunately, a couple of months after filing that application, he passed away. But before he died, he gave instruction to his lawyer that he wanted the case to continue beyond his death. And there wasn't much authority about how to do that. So generally, under the common law that we have inherited from England, once you die, that's it. That's the end of the journey for your case. So his lawyer looked at some authority, I believe, from Canada and showed up to court along with the Crown. And a comment was made from Justice Glazebrook, who was one of the judges on the bench of the Supreme Court, just asking quite casually, look, would Tikanga have anything to say about this issue, about whether this case should continue after the death of Mr. Ellis? And the lawyer thought about it and said, look, maybe, but we're going to need some time. So the court adjourned, and there was a process of about 6 months where there was a wānanga of experts and lawyers, and not just lawyers for Mr. Ellis and for the Crown, but lawyers representing the Māori Lawyers Association, Te Hungaroia, and they produced an agreed statement of tikanga. There's tikanga ideas that were relevant to Mr. Ellis's case. Now, it's important to note here that Mr. Ellis was Pākehā. He wasn't Māori, and as far as we know, none of those children involved in that case were Māori either. But a whole range of tikanga concepts were found to be relevant to this case. They included hara, which is the idea of there's been a wrong, ia, which is a state of balance you need to reach after there had been a hara, and also this concept of mana. For those not familiar with the idea of mana, it's one of those things that doesn't translate very well into English, but it's kind of like a power, spiritual authority. Sometimes it's translated as prestige, and it can flow, right? Your mana can be influenced by things you do and things you don't do. It can be influenced by actions of people around you and your whānau, or where you are in the family line. But the Supreme Court there held that elements to do with Mr. Ellis's mana were useful in determining that this case should in fact go forward after his death. So they decided effectively that these historic convictions could have such a negative impact on his mana, even after his death, that they would proceed with looking into the conviction. And eventually, as we know, they did overturn his convictions, but they did that on a basis of a range of factors, not just the idea of mana. But what this case really did was catapult this tikanga concept of mana into, you know, inherited from England common law, our mainstream common law system. And another key point was that mana relates to everyone. It doesn't matter if you're Pākehā, if you're Māori, if you're from another country and you showed up yesterday off the plane. In this country, you have mana, and that is relevant to the justice system. When the Supreme Court makes a judgment like Ellis, it delivers a judgment, those ideas start to flow down into the lower court. And if the lower courts are deciding an issue that's very similar to the Supreme Court, often the Supreme Court decisions will bind them. So we've got now that the High Court and the District Court are starting to deal with issues of mana, which brings us to these two other cases. So in the Green and Police case, Mr. Green owned a logging company, and he was an established member of his iwi, sat on the board. He was a kaumātua and had considerable knowledge of the whakapapa of his whānau, and one of his truck drivers crashed. So he showed up to the crash site, and the police officer who was controlling the site said to him, don't come on site. But Mr. Green was really concerned about his truck driver, and he went on and checked on his truck driver, who was a family friend, you know, out of concerns of manaakitanga, so that sort of ethic of care, kindness, reciprocity. And he took photos of the site as well, and he was charged with obstruction of an officer. And he first went to the district court, and he applied for what's called a discharge without conviction. So under the Sentencing Act, if the consequences of a conviction outweigh the seriousness of the offence, you can apply for what's called a discharge without conviction. So the judge basically says you're free to go, there's nothing on your record. So he applied for a discharge without conviction on several grounds, but the main one was that a conviction would seriously impact on his mana. And his counsel presented evidence from Kaumatu, a senior elder in the tribe, who explained how this case would have an impact on Mr. Green's mana, and the judge decided that he would grant this discharge without conviction on that. So a second case is called Sweeney and the prison manager of Spring Hill Corrections Facility. Mr. Sweeney, he had been an addictions counsellor at prison, and he had posted the material on, I believe, Facebook that insinuated that he was connected to the mongrel mob, and he had his visitor access from the prison revoked, and he sued the manager. And initially, in the first instance, it was found in Mr. Sweeney's favour that his visitor access shouldn't have been revoked. Then this next case came along where he tried to argue for the creation of a new tort based on damage to his mana. And the court can create new torts. But Mr. Sweeney took quite a novel approach and said, look, this revocation of my visitor access, that's really impacted my mana, and I would like you, High Court, to recognise a new tort based on damage to my mana, and the damage to my mana I valued at $325,000. And the judge said no, and the judge set out a few reasons as to why he said no, but the key one is he found that tikanga principles alone don't give rise to causes of action at common law. That's probably the key one there. So tikanga influences common law, we know that, but tikanga principles alone, standing on their own two feet, don't give rise to fresh common law actions. I mean, the Green case was active in its use of mana, and the Sweeney case didn't allow Mr. Sweeney really to run that argument, but it just shows that these ideas are now being used more commonplace in our lower courts as well.
There is an understanding that everyone is born with mana, but mana is not equal across everybody. So then the amount of mana one holds could change how the court makes a judgment, right? How then have the courts been able to weigh up the mana of these individuals so far?
That's a really good question. And you're right, everyone in this country has mana. So tikanga is a question of law to be proved by fact. And what that means is that you've got to produce evidence as to what the tikanga is. And in the Green case, that was an affidavit, so a written piece of evidence that Mr. Green's lawyers produced, where someone gave some evidence about the impacts of this case on his mana. And so the judge was able to look to that evidence to influence that decision. Now, the Sweeney case didn't really pursue to a weighing up stage, so I can't tell you what the judge would have done in that case. But I mean, in some aspects, I guess it's not that dissimilar to the English concept of damage to reputation, right? And if I was to go to court and ask the judge to look into something that I say has impacted my reputation, I would have to produce affidavit evidence from people who knew me, who are standing in the community saying how it had impacted my reputation. And that's probably how it's going to be dealt with by the courts. The problem I think we have is we are asking generally non-Māori judges who have been trained in a non-Māori legal system to weigh up these elements of mana. And it's possible that they might do this inappropriately or not really know how to deal with this. That is possible. Now, I will note as well that I put out an article in The Conversation about this, and after that I did this, I had an email from a retired district court judge, and he was out of the Northern jurisdiction, and he said that he was doing this sort of thing in the 90s, that using mana in a discharge without conviction application was something that he was utilising. So it's not completely a novel thing, but it definitely has, I guess, attracted more attention in the post-Alice environment.
To kind of add on to what you're saying there, do you think then that we need a stronger focus on applying tikanga in legal education?
I really do. And that's part of my job, I've got to declare that. So one of the things I do at the University of Canterbury is I teach how tikanga Māori interacts with our common law system. And we need that for all elements of our legal profession. It can't just be our baby lawyers who are coming out, our grads with this knowledge. Currently practicing lawyers need to be doing that upskilling, that learning. And, you know, some of them are doing that through what's called continuing professional development, or CPD, but others aren't. And our judges as well are receiving some education, I believe, through the Judicial Education Institute, and that's great, but we do need to start at a very basic level. For some people who have never, ever thought about tikanga or come across tikanga concepts, they might not have even been on a marae, you know, until they've come to law school. So we are starting with very basic ideas with our first years, and now we're weaving it all the way through the degree, and I teach at first, second and third level, and I will teach these ideas across every single student who sits in front of me this year. I think I'll have about 900 individual people will learn about tikanga concepts in some way. Wanted to make the note that about 10 years ago, Justice Joe Williams put out an article called Lex Aotearoa, and you can Google that and find that. And he came up with this idea of a third law of Aotearoa. So he said that, look, tikanga was our first law, English common law was our second law, but now we're in a third law stage where tikanga is influencing common law and potentially vice versa. And I think that these cases are really showing that we are in that third law stage, and I think we're going to be seeing more of these cases related to not just mana but other tikanga principles coming through the courts.
That was lecturer at the University of Canterbury's Faculty of Law, Rachel Evans, speaking to me about the courts using mana in judgments.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.